Trevor Zamparelli on 2FM
with Virgin Mobile. Go from scrolling through stories to creating your own. Freedom is calling. Virgin Mobile. Bring on amazing.
So, lads, think about it. Every pet owner really thinks that their dog or cat or fish or hamster, whatever, is a genius. But are they? Are they really? Brian Butterworth is a neuroscientist and the author of The Mathematical Brain, and he has been examining this for his latest book, Can Fish Count? And he's on the line now. Brian, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for so much for doing this. Brian, before we look at animals, let's start with ourselves. We're surrounded by numbers every minute of every day. How many are we talking here at any given moment? Because I know you looked at this quite recently.
I did look at it. I reckon on a Saturday when I'm not working, and remember I'm a scientist, so I deal with numbers for work, I reckon I probably deal with at least 1,000 numbers an hour, or 16,000 numbers in a waking day. I may even dream numbers. It's much more difficult to count them if you're dreaming.
Oh my God, that's a lot of numbers. That's a lot to deal with. No wonder some of us are so forgetful. How many of us, though, are good with numbers? I mean, I'm 40 and I still count with my fingers.
Well, most people are okay. I mean, there are two groups of people who are not quite so good. The first of these are called dyscalculics, and this is something you inherit, rather like dyslexia, or you inherit in many cases, like dyslexia.
Okay.
And it's about the same prevalence as dyslexia, but it's even more of a handicap in your everyday life than dyslexia, because very difficult to hold down a job if you can't kind of work out how many things you should be sending out and how much money you should be getting for them. So that's one group who are not very good. Another group who are actually not as bad, but they're people who live in societies where they don't count, where they don't actually have counting words. And we've actually tested some of these people in Australia, where some of the indigenous tribes, in fact, most of the indigenous tribes there have languages where they don't have counting words. So they can't do 1, 2, 3, 4, or they don't do 1, 2, 3, 4. But if you test them in the right way, you find out that their brains are just like ours. So it's not really just a question of going to school and or learning at home.
Is, yeah.
The counting words. Yeah, it's something that's, for most of us, or for 95% of us, it's in our brains already.
Great. Another thing I can blame my parents on. Brian, and years ago, when people were bartering, they were counting without words, as you mentioned there. So just explain again, how did that work years ago?
With bartering? Well, that's interesting, because with bartering, you just take something and you say, I'll give you this if you give me those. But there was a very interesting historical moment in the Middle East, in what was called the Fertile Crescent, about, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago, when people started to have an agricultural surplus. And so they would send their products, let's say, vats of oil to another place, and they would expect to get something in return. For this, they needed to have accounts and accountants. And this is where actually writing started, saying, I've just sent you 5 barrels of oil. Can you send me 3 sheep in return? And so you had to have a way of documenting what you were sending and what you needed back in return.
Which brings us on to apes and monkeys. Let's talk about this in the book and all that. You often hear the expression, you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. But we're probably not giving monkeys enough credit there, are we?
Well, there's been quite a lot of research now on monkeys and indeed on monkey brains. And they're not bad up to about 8 or 9. They can count up to that number. They can say that 8's more than 6, for example. They're not bad at that. They can do a bit of simple addition. So if you put, if you drop bits of food into a bucket one at a time, then they know how many bits of food there are in that bucket. And if you do it in 2 different buckets and you put fewer pieces in the other bucket, they know which bucket's got the more pieces of food. So they can sort of add one by one by one, and they can then compare the results if there are two lots of one by ones. So that's one thing. But there was a very interesting study published a year or two ago in which monkeys actually bargained with people. I didn't know about this till I started researching the book. But in one particular temple in India, there are some macaque monkeys. And what they do is they steal things from the tourists. I mean, the tourists are told, don't, for God's sake, leave any of your valuables easily taken by these monkeys. So the monkeys would take things like glasses or scarves or even cameras, and then they would negotiate to return them to you for food.
And they
learnt, you know, which things that you that they'd stolen were worth more bits of food. And this is something they learned. So the young monkeys aren't very good at the negotiations, but the older monkeys are, and it's something that's entirely learned. But in order to learn it, they had to have some numerical capacity in their little brains.
In their brains to start with. Yeah. Are some species just smarter than others? Can we talk about, let's talk about mice and rats, because they're often used in labs, but they're extraordinary, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, most of the fundamental methods that we use come from work with rats in labs. Mice turned out to be very good as well, even though mice have much smaller brains than rats. They can learn to press a lever up to 40 times. So they only get rewarded if they press the lever at least 40 times. And they can learn to do this.
Wow.
And they do it in a kind of optimal way. They know if they press it 39 times, 38 times, they don't reach the target, they won't get a reward. But if they go over the target, they will get the reward. But going over the target means some wasted effort. And so it's now thought that they have a kind of optimal strategy, rather like we would have. So they go just over the target, just to make sure that they do get the reward.
And what about animals in the wild? I mean, how clever are they compared to domestic pets, for example?
It's hard to test them in the wild, but they can be pretty good. Mm. So, for example, lions. Lions live in prides. Prides have a territory, and other prides try to invade this territory. Often, this could have very serious consequences. They, for example, commit infanticide on the pride's cubs, or they might sort of run off with the females, or they might kill the dominant males. So it's very important to defend your pride. But the problem is that if you've got two lions fighting, they could do themselves very serious damage. So what turns out to be the case is that a pride will only attack invaders if it outnumbers them, and if it has to outnumber them significantly. If it outnumbers them, then the intruders will run away. So the pride, the defending pride, will win that without actually having to suffer any injuries. So it's very important for them to count how many the invaders are and how many of them there are. Now, one of the interesting things about this is they usually can't see the invaders, because the invaders come sort of in twilight through the long grass of the Serengeti. Mm. And so they can just
I've seen the Lion King.
Yeah, you can see one roar there, one roar there, one roar there. There are three of them. You look around, there are six of us. There are six of us. We're going to charge.
We can do this.
But remember, they're comparing a number of intruders, which they can only hear, with a number of defenders, which they could see. So this is a very abstract ability that these lions have got.
Brian, can I ask you a stupid question?
Yes.
Are the animals with bigger brains sharper?
Not necessarily. It depends a bit what you mean by bigger brains. Do you mean brains which are physically bigger or brains that have got more neurons?
Physically.
In that case, no, because some of the best counters and calculators are birds, and birds have got very small brains because the brains have to be compressed into this aerodynamic shape. So they have very small brains. But one of the things about compressing these brains is that the neurons, the brain cells, are closer together, and this may give them an advantage. So you've got these streamlined little brains, which can actually do very good counting.
Okay, I'm going to stop saying bird brain. You know, someone's a bit stupid to call them bird brain,
absolutely,
because it's a stereotype I'm now not comfortable with.
Yeah.
Now, listen, my kids, they're at me to get a pet, dog or cat. Now, it seems that the stereotype there, or the impression, is that cats are smarter. Is that factually, is that true?
it depends what you mean by smarter. I mean, our cats are, I would say, not very smart. They know what they want, and they're very good at getting it, but I don't think they're very smart, really.
Okay.
However, they're on tests of numerical ability, the very old tests of numerical ability, they turn out to be very good, better than the dogs that have been tested. So maybe in one area, they could be smarter than dogs.
We have to come to the big question. The title of your book, I mean, we joke about having the memory of a goldfish and they have tiny brains and all that. But can fish actually count, or do we have to buy the book to get the answer?
No, you don't have to buy the book. and I wouldn't have given that title if I didn't know what the answer is. It depends, of course, what you mean by counting. So what I mean by counting is establishing the number of objects in a collection. So we do that by going 1, 2, 3, 4 and counting the objects in the collection. Now, of course, fish, as far as we know, don't have counting words, but they can assess how many objects there
they
are.
They can count.
They can count in that sense. And not only can they count, they can actually do some addition and subtraction, and they can compare two collections, which one's got more. And this is very important. Because if they go into the larger, what we call a shoal, the larger shoal, then they're safer than if they're in a smaller shoal.
Yeah.
And so they have to be able to count these two shoals, or however many shoals there are, and make an assessment of which one has the more.
So they'd be like, there's 25 lads, there's 25 lads in that one, there's 10 lads in that one. I'll go with the one with the 10 lads because the smaller shoal is, they're very clever. Forget about the cat and the dog. I'm going to get a goldfish because there's only room for one stupid person or thing in my house, and that's me. The book is fascinating stuff. It really is. But it says here as well, just going back to fish because I'm really intrigued. Salmon are very clever. Are they the cleverest?
People don't really test salmon in the lab very much because they're rather big and expensive. So we tend to test rather small fish. But salmon are one of these creatures, and there are many of them in the world, who have a tremendous memory for where they're born. So they can go off and swim around in the Atlantic Ocean, maybe for more than a year, and then come back to the river in which they were born. So
incredible.
That means navigation of a very high order. And I've argued in the book that navigation of a very high order needs numbers. So when you think, for example, of Google Maps is just a big set of numbers. And when you're going from A to B on Google Maps, you say, find the way to Piccadilly Circus. What Google Maps does is it does a computation over stored numbers, ultimately just zeros and ones. And I think that that's what salmon and other migrating fish and migrating birds do. And they navigate over enormous distances. I mean, if you take some migrating birds, they migrate from the northern, one migrates from Alaska to New Zealand every year and back again.
Incredible.
I mean, it's extraordinary. And this is better than Google Maps because it's not in two dimensions. They have to work out how high they should be flying in order to get the right winds or to avoid the wrong winds. And so it has to be a map in three dimensions that they're using in order to get from Alaska to New Zealand.
Insane. Brian, come here to me now. Did you always want to be a scientist?
No, I sort of drifted into it.
How do you drift into being a scientist?
It's a very long story. I started really thinking about mathematics and the foundations of mathematics. What are numbers really, is what I started thinking about. And I was thinking about this from a mathematical or a logical or philosophical point of view. And then one day I had the opportunity to test some patients who had difficulty with numbers. They seemed to be okay, then they had a stroke, and then their number ability seems to have disappeared.
Right.
And so I was looking at, the neural foundations of numerical ability rather than logical foundations. And that's how the whole thing started. What we found was that, you know, there's a particular bit of the brain, of the human brain, that does most of the work. And so I started to say, well, you know, why this bit of the brain? Do you find this bit of the brain still working in babies? Do you find it working in other animals? So it sort of just kind of drifted
snowballed
into it.
Wow. Well, listen, it's really interesting stuff. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And thanks for coming on the show. That is Brian Butterworth. Can fish count? What animals reveal about our uniquely mathematical mind? There we go. Go and grab it. It's a really great read. And we'll be back after this.
Jennifer Zaffarelli. Weekday morning from 9 on 2FM.